The Israelites arrived at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19, and God said, "Nobody touch the mountain, or you will die." Moses could go up, and later, there were some others who could go part of the way. Most of the Israelites remained at the foot of the mountain, if not farther back. The levels of ascent, thinking about levels or degrees, the levels of ascent had to do with the holiness and glory of God being manifest on that mountain. Levels of access, think about it that way. If you were to go to a particular government office and want to go to just any floor, you would have to have a kind of clearance. And you can't just go anywhere you would want in certain buildings. And that's because the idea of access and clearance matters for the sacredness or secrecy of what is happening. Here, the tabernacle has a sacredness of holiness that was foreshadowed by the Mount Sinai experience. In fact, you might say that the tabernacle was a kind of Mount Sinai. They had to leave Sinai. They couldn't stay there. So the realities of Sinai were captured in this tent, this portable dwelling place. The courtyard of the tabernacle is kind of like the bottom of the mountain. Israelites could be at the bottom of the mountain. They could be inside the courtyard. Only the priests could go into the tent itself, known as in the first room, the holy place. That's like going part of the way up the mountain. But only the high priest could enter the innermost room, known as the most holy place. That's like Moses going all the way to the top to meet with the Lord. So degrees of holiness in the tabernacle were reflected earlier in the degrees and levels of access in Sinai. You might describe the degrees of holiness in the tabernacle as like a heavenly ascent. For the mountain image of going from the ground, level with the earth, all the way upward, and mountains were heavenly points of divine encounters in the Old Testament, then going into the tabernacle, and the farther you went into the tabernacle, it's as if you were leaving earth and going into the presence of God himself. In fact, in the innermost room, you would find yourself before the Ark of the Covenant if you were the high priest, and there would be cherubim right there over the Ark of the Covenant on the lid, cherubim which praise and honor the Lord among the heavenly host. It's as if you would have entered heaven itself. Now, you would then, if you were the high priest, back out and leave after the Day of Atonement ritual was over. On that single day a year, you would go behind that veil, and the access would then be denied for anyone until the following Day of Atonement year in their seventh month. So these degrees of holiness in the tabernacle reflected earlier in the Mount Sinai matters not just because of the Sinai connection, but earlier, much earlier. Think Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, you had a garden in Eden and then what was outside of Eden, levels of sacredness. So that when Adam and Eve are exiled, the whole world was not a garden. There was a garden that was a part of this world that needed to be subdued and its image bearers to exercise dominion over. Well, Adam and Eve were exiled out of the garden and they were sent into out of the east of the garden into the world outside. What the Israelites are going to do now is remarkable because this tabernacle is entered on the eastern side. This reminds us of the Garden of Eden. Just as Adam and Eve were exiled and would not return, the tabernacle is a kind of installment of the hope that we will dwell with God. So just as Adam and Eve were exiled to the east, the garden tabernacle connection is this. The tabernacle is not just entered in any direction. It's entered from the east. As if the place that was the exit and exile will now be the entrance toward the presence of God for the Israelites, represented ultimately by the high priest. I think this is a way of saying Israel is like a corporate Adam. Just as Adam was exiled as an individual, God is bringing his people into his presence, his way, his timing, all part of his unfolding plan. In chapter 26, here's what we're going to think about with this tabernacle. It was mainly comprised of materials or curtains and wood, curtains and wooden frames. They were decorated and overlaid with different things, but this was not a solid walled structure. You couldn't, run your hand over a walled part of the tabernacle. It just wasn't made that way. In these first 14 verses, we're going to see layers of the tabernacle. Now, what you have behind me is this depiction of the courtyard, which is all the area around the tent. And you see that tent itself covered up. Those coverings, that's what we're going to read about in just a moment. It was covered very specifically in a certain order and by certain materials. There was an innermost layer, a second layer, a third layer, and a fourth. Four layers of coverings over this structure. This would keep it very, very dark. You can imagine if you have enough coverings and curtains over something, light's eventually not going to get in. But it would also keep elements out, like rain and other disastrous things that you would not want working its way into a sacred space. And so in verse 1, he says, "You shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen, blue and purple and scarlet yarns. You shall make them with cherubim skillfully worked into them." So what you have here is this depiction of several layers, and they have them kind of peeled back with this illustration so that you can see in the innermost layer there is this fabric, this linen, that has certain colors, blue, purple, and also scarlet yarns, and cherubim are woven into them. That is not a randomly chosen figure. A cherubim would remind us of the Garden of Eden, where cherubim with the flaming swords deny access. And here, the people of God, represented by the priests, will have access surrounded by the cherubim. The cherubim will not be keeping them out. They are dwelling and entering the place where the cherubim are depicted on these curtains. These are 10 curtains, it says, comprised of this particular material. And in verses 2 and 3, we're told that the length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits, and the breadth of each curtain 4 cubits. We don't think about things in cubits. Here's the lengths. Curtains 42 feet long, 6 feet wide. Well, now that's enormous. 42 feet long, 6 feet wide. That's an extraordinary. Now, each of these 10 would be that long, and they would be connected together by loops and clasps, so that you have this layer of the innermost layer comprised of this carefully woven and threaded material, and it's massive in scope. So in verses 2 and 3, the length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits and the breadth 4 cubits. All the curtains shall be the same size. 5 will be coupled to one another and the other 5 coupled to one another. You end up with all 10 curtains being connected in some form to form a massive innermost layer. In verses 4 through 6, you shall make the loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain in the first set, and likewise make loops on the edge of the outermost curtain in the second. And so the bordered loops would connect from one set to the second set to make a massive inner layer. 50 loops you shall make on the one curtain, 50 loops you shall make on the edge of the curtain in the second set. The loops shall be opposite one another, and you shall make 50 clasps of gold, and couple the curtains one to the other with clasps, so that the tabernacle may be a single whole. We should imagine then this innermost layer covering the sides of this tabernacle and even dipping into the back quite a ways with some leftover feet. It's a big linen set of curtains all clasped together, one gigantic fabric. One estimate is it was somewhere between 42 by 60 feet long by the time all of this was carefully put together. Now in verse 7, the second layer, okay? So if you were to see the innermost layer, here's that orangish looking one. It says in verse 7, "You shall make curtains of goat's hair for a tent." Now that's a lot of goats that have to go into the making of this curtain. I'm just saying, this is not like one goat, okay? It's like a whole family of goats. It says in verse 7, "This will be for the tent over the tabernacle. 11 curtains shall you make." So this is going to be even larger than the innermost layer. And in verse 8, "The length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits." Can you imagine going to somebody's home? What are those curtains made out of? Well, it's goat's hair, friend. Goat's hair. You find something unusual about this, like they're skinning animals. But this is no doubt to help preserve from the elements the innermost layer that was interwoven with cherubim, that you would only see that innermost layer inside the tabernacle. Well, the goat skins, they don't have anything creative woven in it. You're not going to be able to see the goat skins inside the tabernacle anyway, just the innermost curtain right above you. And so in verse 8, the length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits and the breadth 4. This is larger than the first layer. So it would cover entirely that innermost one. You will double in verse 9, couple 5 curtains by themselves and 6 by themselves, the 6th curtain double over in the front of the tent. Meaning, I think that as it covers over the second layer, if you have it all the way draped, it'll even peek over into the front of the tabernacle, concealing the innermost linen curtain. In verses 10 and 11, you shall make 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that is outermost in one set, and 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that is outermost in the second. You shall make 50 clasps of bronze and put clasps into the loops and couple the tent together that it may be a single whole. All of those verses are basically saying you have all of these curtains and you're going to attach them together. This will also be the way of disassembly, because the tabernacle was to be portable. Can you just imagine sort of the painstaking responsibilities of these certain Levite clans? They're going to have to unclasp everything, roll everything up, transport it, unroll everything, reclasp everything, layer upon layer upon layer. This would take place every time the tabernacle was to be reset up. In these two layers, let me make an observation about the material gold and bronze. Notice earlier, in the innermost layer, gold clasps were to be made. That's because anything in any way visible in the tabernacle itself was gold. But goat skins, well, you can't see those. And so when they're clasped together, a less precious metal is used. You're using bronze, we're told in verses 10 and 11. Verses 12 and 13, the part that remains of the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that remains, shall hang over the back of the tabernacle. And the extra that remains in the length of the curtains, the cubit on the one side, the cubit on the other, shall hang over the sides of the tabernacle on this side and that side to cover it. I think what all that language is basically saying is this second layer is so big that not only is it covering the innermost linen layer, it is draping over the sides and even onto the ground and even in the back of the tabernacle itself. Now, we can't see the back here, but the back of it would be covered and then some by this second layer. Then in verse 14, you shall make for the tent a covering of tanned ram's skins. That's the third layer. Now, we're not even told anything else about how many loops, how many clasps, or how long. Because at this point, the intent is, well, at least the length and breadth of the previous one. We at least want that linen innermost layer to be covered. So the tanned ram skins, even though dimensions aren't given, I think by implication they would just duplicate the second layer. So this third layer of ram skins is followed by a covering of some sort of goat skins, which can be translated different things, but it's a certain kind of leather that would keep out all of the elements, hot sun, rain, dew, dust, sand, all of the things that you would not want messing up your beautiful place. So those 14 verses are giving for us an innermost layer of linen and then a bunch of animal skins. Now, I just want to make a big point here about these first verses. The linen reference, or the fabric, is going to be the same kind of material for the priestly garments. And the priests are going to work inside the tabernacle. They're going to maintain the facility and the furnishings. So what they're going to be wearing, it's like they're looking around and seeing the same material. And so there's a priestly connotation to it, I think. Not only that, Adam and Eve, just think about Eden again, Adam and Eve were covered by the Lord with animal skins. This is significant because there are various things and coverings that were used in the ancient world, but layer upon layer of animal skins are covering this particular place. So if it's like Adam and Eve returning to Eden in the nation of Israel, corporate Adam, they are once again covered by the skins of animals going in there for the priestly work that is inside. In verses 15 to 30, here's what we know about these curtains and these linens. It's surrounding a bunch of frames. I told you earlier that these weren't walls, okay? These are frames. And in verses 15 through 30, we're going to think about these frames for the tabernacle. He says in verse 15, you shall make upright frames for the tabernacle of acacia wood. Now, acacia wood, that ought to sound familiar at this point. It was used in the making of the Ark of the Covenant. It was used in the making of the table that held the bread. And it's going to be used for the making of these frames. acacia wood. And we're going to learn later that these frames, in terms of height, are 15 feet high. So on your little rough drawing that I provided you, one of the things I list at the bottom, right under the tabernacle sketch, is the height. That the height of the tabernacle was 15 feet, which means these frames are going to hold these curtains 15 feet in the air, all of these four layers of linen and all these animal skins, okay? Made of acacia wood, these frames are. And they, when I say frames, I mean they're two long poles held together in the middle by short bars. They look like a wooden ladder. So if you would have imagined a ladder, you've got two sides, and then you've got these poles in the middle that are binding it together. That is one frame. Okay, that little contraption there, one frame. It tells us in verses 16 and 17, 10 cubits shall be the length of each frame, which is 15 feet. A cubit and a half the breadth, a little over 2 feet wide. There shall be two tenons in each frame for fitting together. So shall you do for all the frames of the tabernacle. What this basically means is two wooden pieces, 15 feet long, held together by wooden bars, all made of acacia wood. In verses 18 and 19, you'll make the frames of the tabernacle 20 for the south side. 40 bases of silver you shall make under the 20 frames. Two bases under one frame for its two tenons, and two bases under the next frame. Here's what this means. If you think of I don't have a picture of that, but if you see the very bottom of those wooden posts, that would be what you would call the base. And so if you have this ladder-like structure, well, you have two bottoms of poles, don't you? So for each frame, you need not one, but two bases. And that's what you're going to see in verses 18 and 19. You have 20 frames on the south side, which means if we were to back up here, this entrance here, this is the eastern side. It's just turned a little bit so that we can, it's like we're walking into it. But it's the eastern side. But this means that on the eastern side of the tabernacle, you've got here the south side, west side, north side. When he says here in verses 18 and 19, 20 frames for the south side, he means that this side over here is going to have 20 ladder-like constructions. And they are going to be 15 feet high, a little over 2 feet wide, and each pole of the ladder-like structure, or the frame, is going to sit into bases. In verses 18 and 19, notice that the bases will be made of silver. And you shall make 20 frames, two bases for each frame. Then in verses 20 and 21, for the second side of the tabernacle, the north side, 20 frames. Notice the south and the north sides have the same amount of frames, 20 on each side. And that's because they're the same length. They are 30 or 45. The whole tabernacle is 45 feet wide. Or 45 feet long, depending on the direction you're looking at it. Then in verses 20 and 21, what we see is on the north side, 20 frames, 40 bases of silver, two bases under one frame, two bases under the next. In verse 22, for the rear of the tabernacle westward, you will make six frames. That number change is significant. All of a sudden, we went from 20 on this side, 20 on this side, to six on the western part. Now, why the difference? Well, it's a difference in length, isn't it? It's just not as long. In fact, it's only 15 feet wide. So whereas earlier you needed 20, here you only need six in verse 22. And then in verses 23 and 24, you shall make two frames for corners of the tabernacles in the rear. They shall separate beneath, but be joined at the top. I think what we should imagine, this is a good image, like an A-frame structure that will be for support at these corners here. One here and one here, the southwest corner and one at the northwest corner. You have these, I think, mentioned in verses 23 and 24 for the corners. They will separate at the very bottom, but they will be joined at the top in a ring. Thus it shall be for both of them, and they form the two corners. Then in verse 25, there shall be eight frames on that western side, six, and then the two at the corner, so six plus two is eight. Their bases will be silver, 16 bases, therefore, since eight frames a base for each bottom of the pole, 16 bases, two bases under one frame, two bases under another. You shall make all of this in verses 26 through 28 out of acacia wood. Five for the frames of the one side of the tabernacle, five bars for the frames of the other side of the tabernacle, and five bars for the frames of the side of the tabernacle at the rear westward. A middle bar halfway up the frames shall run from end to end. I think what's being shown here you see some of them. You see these long pieces that go from one end to the next. I think that's what's in view here for support. And we would imagine a structure of a house being built this way. If you rip off all the sheetrock or take off all the bricks and you see any wooden structures that lie within, you not only see vertical poles and posts, you see things going horizontal as well to connect. So not only are there connections within each frame, even across the breadth of the tabernacle, there are these long wooden poles that are being made out of acacia wood. We also know that in verse 29, they are overlaid with gold. All the frames, all the rings, all the bars. So by the time all of this is said and done, all of this wood is going to be covered in gold. And why? Because it's the tabernacle. This isn't for bronze or silver time. This is the inside of the tabernacle that anyone working inside is going to see this structure. So here's what we should think then if we are the priests. If we go into the tabernacle, we're going to see this structure from the inside. If you're not a Levitical priest, you're only going to see, looking on the outside, the outermost curtain. That's all you see. You can't visibly look at all the innermost structure. But if you are a priest from Levi's tribe who is working that particular day, you're going to see the inside of the tabernacle structure, and therefore it needs to be of gold. Everything in those rooms is overlaid with gold, except the lampstand, which is made entirely of gold. No acacia wood there. So in verse 30, you shall erect the tabernacle according to the plan for it that you were shown on the mountain. Now, what's happening in these first 30 verses is basically the writer giving you a lot of detail. And friends, listen, it is not easy to talk out loud about all of these cubits and heights and stuff. I don't imagine it's always easy to hear either. The amount of detail is basically to say it is layered over and it is supported with wooden frames. And then you get a lot of detail unpacking that, all of it overlaid with gold on the inside. This is exactly as God showed to Moses when they were going to construct it. They were to obey the instructions. This is God's house. We should think of it like a house. The tent of meeting or the tabernacle is a dwelling place. It's a symbol of God's presence with them, and he would manifest his glory in the most holy place, that small room. Then in verses 31 through 33, well, there's got to be an entrance. So if you look at this particular picture, here's a side view cutout, okay? Here is the eastern entrance into the tabernacle, and the high priest, or whoever this is going to see the table of bread. We talked about that in Exodus 25. The lampstand, that's from Exodus 25. But he's going to get to this large curtain known as a veil. And that's what we're going to read about in verses 31 to 33. You shall make a veil of purple and blue and scarlet yarns and fine twisted linen. It shall be made with cherubim skillfully worked into it. Now notice again that theme of cherubim showing up over and over. It's all about Eden, folks. The cherubim were keeping Adam and Eve out. And here the high priest is going to go through the cherubim by going into that curtain. The symbolism is powerful. We are regaining Eden by the mercy of God. He is bringing his people into this garden structure, if you will. And look around. There's food in this garden. There's a tree in this garden, which the lampstand represents. It's full of light and nourishment. Eden is enterable only by the mercy and mediating work of God and his people. And I think in verses 31 through 33, this veil is another thing that reminds us of Eden. In verse 32, they will hang it on four pillars of acacia wood overlaid with gold, with hooks of gold on four bases of silver, which means gold is going to hook the veil at the top, and the bases of the pillars which give it structure are going to have silver bases at the bottom. And then you have in verse 33, you shall hang the veil from the clasps and then bring the ark of the testimony in there within the veil. And the veil shall separate for you the holy place from the most holy. So let's be real clear here on this structure. If I could go back here to my first picture, this little structure here, that's the tabernacle. The area all around it is the courtyard. When we enter this tabernacle, we're immediately brought into a bigger room. This room is known as the holy place. It's separated by this veil that conceals the Ark of the Covenant, this most holy place. So on your paper structure, what I give you is the sky view of the 15x30 holy place, the larger room, and then the 15x15x15 cube-shaped most holy place. Then in verse 34 and 35, you shall put the mercy seat on the Ark of the Testimony in the most holy place. The mercy seat's the lid. So this lid on top of the Ark of the Covenant is the mercy seat. It's got two cherubim facing one another with their heads down and their wings outstretched. Then he says, you shall, in verse 35, set the table outside the veil and the lampstand on the south side of the tabernacle opposite the table. And you shall put the table on the north side. So if we're entering from the east, then this is the northern side where the table for bread is. And this is the south side where the lampstand goes. So this depiction is a way of showing you what verses 34 and 35 look like. The ark is where it is, and the lampstand and the table of bread are where they are, because God said, put it here, put it there, not just anywhere you want. You might arrange your house any way you want. God didn't give you that freedom if you're an Israelite to arrange his house however you want. You go in there and you put what he wants where, and the furniture's not going to be arranged differently when you come back the next time. In verses 36 and 37, not only do we have this curtain separating here, you also see an entrance here into the tabernacle's big room itself. That's in verses 36 and 37, a screen for the holy place. In verse 36, you shall make a screen for the entrance of the tent, of blue and purple and scarlet yarns and fine twined linen embroidered with needlework. This is not fast, quick activity. You think about the kind of time that you're taking into this. Not every piece of the tabernacle is like that. You got a whole layer of goat skin. Nobody's weaving anything into that. But here you've got these curtains, these veils. Well, here, and then the entrance into the tent itself, these would take time to construct and put together. Fine twined linen, embroidered with needlework. And in verse 37, you shall make for the screen five pillars of acacia, overlay them with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold, and their five bases of bronze for them. And so you have it being hung as well. And therefore, when we have this big picture, here you have the outermost screen that verses 36 and 37 talk about. You would enter that only if you were the priests. So here's how the levels of access work. If you were an Israelite, you were camping all around outside this fence. But if you wanted to, you could enter the courtyard. Men and women could. But only if you were a priest from Levi's tribe could you enter the tabernacle itself. And only if you were the high priest could you go into the most holy place behind the innermost veil before the Ark of the Covenant, and only once a year. And so there is a replicating of the Mount Sinai experience in this portable dwelling place. And it's all about reclaiming paradise that has been lost, pictured by these wonderful items and furnishings where God is determined to fellowship with his people. And that's what you bring people into your house for. Come, here's the table, here's the light, and you're wanting communion and fellowship. This tabernacle is a way of God saying to his people through this symbolism, I am intending to be your God and you to dwell with me. We're going to dwell together. I am determined that it be such. Nothing will overcome that. Then in chapter 27, yes, chapter 27, flip your Bible page if you need to, we have an altar made of bronze. In verses 1 through 8, you shall make the altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits long, 5 cubits broad. The altar shall be square, and its height 3 cubits. Now, I want to give you a picture here. When I pictured this altar for a lot of years, I just imagined this small thing, maybe about as large as or wide as this pulpit. You know, something that you could do something on that maybe one person would function. This cubit measurement, though, is really striking. It's 7.5 feet square. So this is bigger. This is bigger than Matthew. This is more than a Matthew in every direction. You have here in verse 1, the 3 cubits high. It's 4.5 feet high. All right? This is a massive altar where multiple people are going to be doing things. Now, it says in verse 1 that it's square, 7.5 feet, 7.5 feet, and then 4.5 feet tall. In verse 2, there are going to be horns made for it on the corners. That's what these pointed things are. These are known as the horns of the altar. In fact, some Israelite rituals include taking blood and putting it on the horns of the altar. Now, there's debate among Old Testament scholars as to what they were implying or symbolizing by being on the altar. But it could be representing what other ancient Near Eastern horns on altars meant. And that was some symbol of power or authority something like that. And that may be their purpose on this altar. Notice in verse 2, they're overlaid with bronze. Why is it overlaid with bronze? Because it's not in the tabernacle. It's in the courtyard. So if I could go back to this courtyard here, here is the altar. It's the first thing you see when you enter the courtyard. There it is, this 7.5 foot square, 4.5 foot high altar. What's going on in that altar? Constant sacrifices, offerings being made. People are bringing their animals to the doorway of the courtyard. They're killing their animal. They're bringing it to the priest, and the priest is going to prepare it and offer it up on this altar right there. Because here's the symbolism. The only way you're getting to God is through a substitute. The only way you're getting to God is through sacrifice. That's the lesson from Genesis forward, and it's beautifully pictured right here in the tabernacle. Nobody's getting to the presence of God except through a substitute. That's the only way in. So when Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but by me," he's fulfilling these pictures laid out in the Old Testament that the way to God, to be reconciled to him, is through our ultimate substitute, Christ Jesus himself. In verse 3, you shall make pots for it to receive its ashes. All right, so if things are on fire, it's going to be a lot of residue, a lot of leftover stuff like ashes. Shovels and basins. Well, shovels like cleaning the altar, but also parts of the animal that are left. Notice basins that are there. Well, this would be especially helpful if you needed to catch any blood, and the altar and everything around this altar was a very bloody place. Nothing clean about it. It was bloody and it was smelly and it was constant year after year after year among the Israelite camp. And then in verse 3, you also see forks. Because, well, if that sacrifice is on fire and I need to move it around or turn it or cut it, I'm not just going to, you know, I'm going to have an instrument to use to turn or to move it, just like if you're barbecuing something. And so here, the fork would have been used for that. And fire pans, which may have held certain things for making the fire, such as wood or live coals. All the utensils made of bronze. In verse 4, you shall make for it a grating, a network of bronze. And on the net, you shall make 4 bronze rings at its 4 corners. It's kind of unclear where this net would go. You have some images that look a little bit different than this, where the net is underneath so that if coals and residue are falling, it would be falling into this grate that would catch things. Some say that's where the coals would have been placed so that it could be heating what was above it. So a number of possibilities for this netting. In verse 5, you shall set it under the ledge of the altar so that the net extends halfway down. And you shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with bronze. Poles shall be put through the rings so that the poles are on the two sides of the altar when it is carried. And you shall make it hollow with boards. As it's been shown you on the mountain, so shall it be made. So this is gold on the outside, but it's hollow on the inside. Now, if you have to carry this thing, that's really helpful, praise the Lord, because that means you're not carrying a solid bronze object. Rather, it's been overlaid with bronze. Not that it would be light. It's 7 feet, 7 feet, 4 feet. But you also have poles that are sticking through these rings that, just like the Ark of the Covenant, would have been held by the Israelite tribe carrying it, and they would be going from one place of encampment to the next. So this bronze altar, always burning. If you look in Leviticus 1 through 7, these offerings and sacrifices listed there would be what's being offered on this altar. This is known as the bronze altar, or the altar for burnt offerings, other kinds of offerings too, sacrifices. And the image, the symbol, the theological lesson from it is The only way anybody is getting to the presence of the Lord is through sacrifice. It's the first thing that's there. Now, this communicates something. Symbolically, these barriers and these particular symbols and placements of stuff, this matters because you have the Israelites who, in coming to the Lord, are reminded every time they enter that courtyard, I have to offer something in my place. I don't just traipse in into the presence of the Lord. And not only that, the priests who represent our nation, they're the ones that are going to go into the tabernacle itself. And only the high priest who represents all of us will go into the most holy place. So representation and substitutionary sacrifice are taught. The lesson for the Israelite is to remember that every time we go in, I am unclean before the Lord, unworthy before the Lord, and this sacrifice in my place is what will picture my reconciliation to God. Now, what about the court of the tabernacle that's around it? Well, it's big. In verse 9, you shall make the court of the tabernacle. On the south side, the court shall have hangings of fine twined linen, 100 cubits long for one side, which means 150 feet. So this long fenced area on those two long sides that match, those are 150 feet long. And it's roughly depicted on the picture I gave you. And then it says in verse 10, 20 pillars and their 20 bases shall be made of bronze. So what's hanging up all of these hangings? Pillars. And they're just placed. You see some pillars on the sides between the curtains, and you've got them all attached there. And that's the point. Pillars that are on each side, 20 of them with bronze bases. And the hooks at the top, fillets made of silver. A fillet in this image is something that connects the pillars. So you've got the pillar on one side, the pillar on the other, but you've got to hang the curtain. So the fillet of silver goes across and the curtain is hung on that. So you have all these pillars and all these curtains. So earlier when I said that the tabernacle is basically made of curtains and frames, I wasn't joking. The courtyard and the tabernacle itself is comprised of all of that. Why? Why is it comprised of something so temporal and easily deconstructed? Because they would move. You don't want something difficult to take apart. You want something easy to take apart and easy to put back together. Not that this would have been a piece of cake anyway. But then in verse 11, we see likewise for the length on the north side, hangings 100 cubits long, which means the length of the long sides is the same number of pillars, 20 with 20 bases of bronze. Hooks of the pillars and their fillets are silver. Then in verse 12, the breadth of the court on the west side, this is the far back end of the tabernacle. There are hangings for 50 cubits, and that means 75 feet with 10 pillars and 10 bases. In verses 13 to 15, the breadth of the court on the front to the east, this is the outermost entrance here. That's also going to be 50 cubits, but notice some difference here. You can't just curtain the whole thing off. You've got to have some room for people to enter. So what you have as a color distinction here is you've got on this eastern side here, some pillars that go in on this side, some pillars that go in on this side, and then in the middle, you've got the entrance. A 30-foot entrance, actually. In verses 13 to 15, on the east, there will be 50 cubits, hangings for the one side of the gate, 15 cubits, with three pillars and three bases. On the other side, hangings of 15 cubits, three pillars and three bases. But the gate, in verse 16, there will be a screen 20 cubits long. It's 30 feet. Blue, purple, scarlet, yarns, fine, twisted linen, embroidered with needlework. It shall have four pillars and with them four bases. This is the entrance to the court. In verse 17, the pillars around the court shall be filleted with silver, their hooks of silver and their bases of bronze. In verse 18, the length of the court, 100 cubits and breadth 50. This is just summary, meaning that it's 150 feet wide or long, depending on how you're looking at it, and then 75 feet by 150 feet. The height, 5 cubits, that's 7.5 feet, 5 cubits high. Here's what this would mean. If you were going up to the courtyard, it's 7.5 feet. The tabernacle's taller. So if you're outside the courtyard, you can actually see the top of the tabernacle. It's twice as high as the fence. So you just imagine somebody's home where you have this maybe fenced area, but they've got not a one-story house, but a two-story house. So over the fence, yes, it's a barrier, but because of the height of what's on the other side, I can easily see it from the other side of that fence. And so in verse 18, you have the hangings and the height described there, made of fine twisted linen, twined linen, and bases of bronze. In verse 19, the utensils of the tabernacle for building. I think this means your drills, your screwdrivers, all the things that you would be doing to construct it have to be made of a special material, made out of bronze, along with all the pegs. Well, now we can think here about tenting that we would be familiar with. You've got this covering that you're going to sleep under, but you don't have everything just free flowing, especially when you know the weather might be unfavorable. You've got things anchored down. You've got things pinned to the ground, pegged to the ground. That's what we should imagine going on here. These curtains were not just free flowing in the wind, okay? You have things that are fastened together at the top, pegged down at the bottom, and all of this will be of bronze. In verses 20 and 21, I want to talk about the lampstand. This is that thing from Exodus 25 that was full of light, to be lit every day and to be burning morning and evening. It says in verses 20 and 21, "You shall command the people of Israel that they bring to you pure beaten olive oil for the light, that a lamp may regularly be set up to burn." This means that just as the Israelites are going to bring all these wonderful materials, all the yarns, all the linens, all the skins, they're bringing all this stuff to help construct it. All the acacia wood, the silver, the gold, the bronze. They're also bringing olives to press in a certain way that its oil will be used for the lamps. Seven lamps on this lampstand. Each branch has a lamp at the end of it. So in verse 20, the people of Israel are going to bring you pure beaten olive oil for light, and a lamp will be regularly set up to burn. In verse 21, in the tent of meeting, outside the veil, which means that innermost veil, right outside of it, Aaron and his sons shall tend that lamp from morning to evening before the Lord, which means the priests have the responsibility to keep it lit. It shall be a statute forever to be observed throughout their generations by the people of Israel. Now, you might not leave your lights on all night. Okay, in fact, I imagine that your ritual is to go, maybe if you're the last person up, turn out whatever remaining lights there are and go to bed. But what if God doesn't sleep? What if the God of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps? Then we want to communicate that the lights are always on. We want to communicate that his presence is always with us, that he's always overseeing and administering and sovereign over the actions of Israel and never misses anything with his all-seeing eye. The lights are never to be turned off when the tabernacle is set up. Rather, the lampstand is to burn day and night. For everybody else is going to go to bed, but they have God watching over them. And that's true for us still. Even if you and I turn the lights off before we go to bed, we know what the truth is behind this lampstand. He is always God, 24 hours a day, not just when the sun is up. That is a wonderful thing to affirm, symbolized by the lampstand, to be tended by the priests. Now, the tabernacle is going to be constructed later in Exodus. These are just the instructions for it. But these pictures, these symbols, these furnishings, all the dimensions, all of this is going to put together this dwelling place and a court fenced around it. And these are gospel pictures. I've given some examples already. These are gospel pictures preparing the people of God for greater redemptive truths down the way. Jesus is the greater Ark of the Covenant. He's the better table of bread. He's the brighter lampstand. So that as God who dwells with us, which is what the Ark of the Covenant symbolized, and as everlasting bread, the true bread from heaven, which is what the table symbolized for the people of God, and as the light of the world, he is the endpoint that all of these things temporarily symbolize. He's the greater tabernacle. Think of the whole structure as a whole that we refer to as the tabernacle. John 1:14 says, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us." So while we can be amazed at and in awe at all the different features to this glorious dwelling place, it was temporary for a reason. God would send his son. From the foundation of the world, it was the plan. And so these are gospel pictures embedded in the history of Israel that would reach their endpoint and be eclipsed by and fulfilled in the Son of God who came to tabernacle with us. He is God with us. Think about the veil. This veil, that innermost veil, concealing the Ark of the Covenant. Jesus dies on the cross, and Matthew tells us that the veil was ripped from top to bottom when Jesus said, "It is finished." So this veil that they're spending all this time and all this yarn and all these colors and weaving the cherubim in it was going to be torn from top to bottom when Jesus dies. Why? Because the veil was to keep sinners out and Jesus died to bring them in. Praise God. The veil in the tabernacle in the temple that only the high priest could go through. This tells us that Jesus is the high priest we need because in him we all go in. Jesus is the veil that sinners go through. Hebrews 10:19 says we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh. So just as the veil was ripped from top to bottom, the significance of that timing-wise is that Jesus was being ripped on the cross, being torn unto death, so that he would be the veil for us. And whereas the earlier curtain would keep people out, Christ is bringing sinners in through union and faith in him. Through his flesh, he says, we have confidence to enter the holy places. Any of the Levitical priests would be keeping out all of the Israelites, whoever would dare to enter the tabernacle. And the high priest alone, and one day a year, would enter that most holy place. But Jesus dies upon the cross, and Jesus says, everybody come in. Come, know the Lord in me. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. He is our more effective altar. We thought about the altar in Exodus 27. Jesus is the place and person of sacrifice. You know how many lambs and goats and bulls were slain upon that altar? Neither do I. But so many that it would have been the bloodiest place throughout all of Israel's history, where encampment after encampment, and when the temple was built in Jerusalem, all the sacrifices. The priests leave, and they leave that altar when their turn is over, and the next priests show up, because it had to be ongoing every day. Jesus dies on the cross, and he says, it is finished. However many thousands upon thousands of sacrifices were offered, no priest ever said, it is finished in the Old Testament. No one would take you seriously. Everybody know that your routine or your rotation might be over, but you'll be back. And so will the high priest on the Day of Atonement next year. It's never finished until Jesus. And he says, it is finished. Hebrews 13:10 says, we have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. And the writer goes on to talk about the suffering and sacrifice of Christ. He is our sacrifice and our altar. John Owen said, the altar which we now have is Christ alone and his sacrifice. He was both priest, altar, and sacrifice all in himself. Now, friends, we just look together at all of Exodus 26 and 27. That's a lot of details. That's a lot of text. But listen, friends, there are gospel pictures here we cannot glaze over. These are some of the most difficult passages in the Bible to work through as Bible readers because there's so much difficulty in picturing what's here, which is why pictures and images and sketches are a huge help because it gives us at least some idea of what's going on here. But the people of Israel lived with this thing. They tore it down and they built it up and they tore it down and they built it up. And it was the center of their camp. Their life was around this tabernacle. And friends, our life is to be centered around Jesus Christ. The tabernacle is the center of the life of Israel. And that communicates that Christ is the rightful center of our lives. He is the greater ark, the greater lampstand, the greater table of bread, the greater veil, the greater altar, the greater tabernacle. Everything here with all of its details finds its glorious, climactic endpoint in the Lord Jesus. And we rejoice that that's the case. We rejoice that that's the case. And we marvel at the God who long in ages past prepared the way for Israel so that when the Son of God came, he wasn't coming where there were no expectations or no promises or no pictures, all sorts of things he would begin to draw into himself to be the bread that we need, the life that we need, the water that we need, the tabernacling presence of God with us. He is the one who fulfills this and our greatest sacrifice. When he gives the elements to his disciples at the Last Supper, they're not talking about an animal outside of himself that will be given. He says, this is the blood of the covenant. This is my blood of the covenant given for you. all of those wonderful pictures and structures would reach their culmination in the Lord Jesus Christ. And seeing that fulfillment really matters. Because when we see how God has pictured and prepared the way in the Old Testament, we will be more thrilled by and more amazed at the person and work of Jesus Christ.